It's time for justice. Welcome to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show, heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. on 97.3 FM WRIR and online at www.wrir.org. I'm your host, Marty Wegbright. This show is written and produced by Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. We give free, civil, non-criminal legal aid to low-income people in Richmond, Petersburg, Charlottesville, and surrounding cities and counties. Coming up on this week's show...
I think the Supreme Court decision will help the fair housing movement by clarifying that those types of neutral policies or practices, whether they're instituted intentionally or not, can really serve to perpetuate segregation and block housing opportunities for people. And let me note, and this is very important, that the Supreme Court just confirmed what was in the original Fair Housing Act. And I think the number is 9 courts of appeals across the country since the inception of the Fair Housing Act have held that this type of liability, this disparate effect type of violation, was in the original Fair Housing Act.
Helen Hardiman, Fair Housing Director at Housing Opportunities Made Equal, discusses last month's U.S. Supreme Court decision affirming that housing discrimination can be proved by disparate impact and why that is so important. And during this week's News You Can Use, we'll tell you what to do about substandard care in a nursing home. All that and more coming up. Stay with us. The show is supported in part by a grant from the Virginia Law Foundation. This show, number 273, is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society and gives only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford an attorney, we'll tell you later in the show how to get free legal advice or representation in a civil case. The Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show is heard every Wednesday at 12:30 on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio, and online at www.wrir.org, and is made possible by community radio volunteers at WRIR. And now, this week's News You Can Use. The Richmond Times-Dispatch recently reported that the Envoy of Stratford Hills, a 196-bed nursing home in South Richmond, may be closing because it was terminated from the Medicare program, raising questions about the transfer of its remaining residents to other facilities. The Department of Medical Assistance Services will work with Envoy to help relocate the patients if the home closes. More generally, however, this story also raises questions about who can help when a resident of a nursing home or an assisted living facility receives inadequate or poor care or is not treated with the respect he or she deserves. One proactive thing families can do before placing their loved one in a facility is to check out the Nursing Home Compare, a 5-star rating system based on a number of factors, including the annual state inspections each facility receives from the Virginia Department of Health's Office of Licensure and Certification. The website is www.medicare.gov/nursinghomecompare. Families can also check out the complaint history of a facility by contacting the local long-term care ombudsman. While the Nursing Home Compare website and complaint history offer important information, it is critical that residents and family members also visit the facility to see for themselves how residents are treated, how engaged they are, what the atmosphere of the place is, including how the place looks, smells, and sounds. If problems arise after admission, a resident or family member may want to file a complaint with the Office of Licensure and Certification, or OLC, by calling 1-800-955-1819 or by filing a complaint online. The website is www.vdh.state.va.us/OLC/complaint. OLC is the agency responsible for the annual survey and inspection of nursing facilities and for determining whether the facility is in compliance with state and federal regulations. Local long-term care ombudsmen around the state are another important source of help for residents and their concerned family members. An ombudsman is an advocate for residents in nursing homes and assisted living facilities. While ombudsmen do not have regulatory authority, they are able to provide valuable information and assistance to residents to help them resolve concerns about their rights and their care. To find the local ombudsman who handles nursing homes in your area, you can use the Find Your Ombudsman function at www.elderrightsva.org. With this week's news you can use, this is your host, Marty Wegbright. Welcome back to the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show on WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond Independent Radio. We're here at the offices of Housing Opportunities Made Equal, or HOME. We are speaking with Helen Hardiman, who is the Fair Housing Director at HOME, and we will be talking about fair housing laws in general, and more specifically later on about last month's U.S. Supreme Court decision about disparate impact and how that will help agencies like HOME prove housing discrimination. Welcome back to the show, Helen.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
So to give our listeners an introduction and a background to the topic, what exactly is fair housing? What is prohibited by the fair housing laws?
The general command of the Fair Housing Act is that in a housing situation, it's illegal to discriminate against someone because of their membership in a protected class. I like to think of that law as requiring four elements in order to basically prove your case. So I mentioned housing transaction. That's interpreted very broadly. We're talking about buying or selling a house, renting a house, services connected with buying or selling a house, advertising of home opportunities, homeowners insurance, mortgage lending, appraisals, basically anything that touches housing is going to be covered under the act. So once you have a housing transaction, again, you have to be discriminated against because of your membership in a protected class. And there are 8 protected classes in Virginia. Race, color, religion, which includes having no religion, national origin, which is where you're from or where you're perceived to be from, or your ancestry, your cultures, or even the language that you speak. All of that is included under national origin. Gender, family status, which is having children under 18 in the home or pregnant women. Disability, which is defined really broadly. And then in Virginia, we have the extra protected class of elderliness, which is defined as having reached the age of 55. So again, we've got a housing transaction, a protected class, and then it's illegal to discriminate against someone. So what does discriminate mean, right? That seems kind of vague. But the Fair Housing Act lays out specific types of practices that are illegal to take against someone because of a protected class. So I can go over those, or I can give you a few examples. What would you prefer?
Yeah, why don't you do both? Go over those and give some examples.
Okay. So it's illegal to discriminate against someone by refusing to rent to them or sell to them or otherwise make housing unavailable to them because of their race, color, religion, etc. And this is just basically a landlord saying, sorry, no kids are allowed here. That would be discrimination based on family status. That kind of statement, in addition to constituting a refusal to rent, would actually also be a separate violation because it's a discriminatory statement. So the Fair Housing Act says you can't make discriminatory statements either. And that would be orally, in writing, etc. It's illegal to impose different terms and conditions on people because of their membership in a protected class. This would be like charging higher security deposits to African Americans versus white people. That's obviously illegal. For a housing provider to misrepresent availability, so to say to for example, men that there are 2 1-bedrooms available, and then shortly thereafter, say to a woman who is otherwise, you know, equal to that man, that nothing is available and that she has to be on a wait list. That would be illegal as misrepresenting availability. Residential real estate transactions that discriminate. So again, we talked about mortgage lending. This also has to do with homeowners insurance, how foreclosures are handled, anything of that nature. If any of those adverse actions are taken because of someone's protected class, that would be illegal. And then there's a broad catch-all towards the end of the act that says it's illegal to interfere with someone in exercising their fair housing rights, or basically retaliate against them for leveraging their fair housing rights, or harassing someone in a housing situation because of their membership in a protected class. There are also 3 extra protections for people with disabilities. So the act says it's illegal for a housing provider to deny someone with a disability a reasonable accommodation or a reasonable modification, and there are some minimal accessibility requirements for new apartment buildings being built. And those extra 3 protections, again, just apply to people with disabilities, but we get a lot of calls along those lines.
And you mentioned that there's a 4th element to a fair housing case in addition to the 3 you discussed. What is the 4th element?
Excellent question and good segue. So again, it's illegal to discriminate against someone because of their membership in a protected class. And so when we're thinking about how we're going to prove a case, we really need to dive down and figure out what because of means. And this is how you prove a case. There are 2 basic ways of proving that discrimination was taken because of membership in a protected class. One angle is to try to prove that that adverse action, right, that refusing to rent or whatever, was intentional. So the housing provider was refusing to rent to you intentionally because they didn't want to rent to African Americans. And you can prove that with direct evidence, like, you know, we talked about if a housing provider actually made a statement, hey, no kids. That's pretty direct evidence of intentional discrimination. That landlord did not want to rent to families with kids. You can also use what's called circumstantial evidence to prove intentional discrimination, and that's where fair housing testing is really useful, and Home does that. I mentioned sending, say, a male home seeker out and then see how he's treated by a housing provider. And then Home could send a female home seeker out, and they are otherwise equal, right? So they are looking for the same size unit at the same, you know, start date, they make the same amount of money, they're otherwise equal except for their gender. If they're treated differently, if one of them is treated worse, you can make an inference that that's because of that sole variable on which they differ, which in that case would be gender. So that would be good circumstantial evidence that that landlord did not want to rent to a woman, which would be illegal housing discrimination based on gender.
So in those cases, you're actually gathering evidence, whether it's somebody who comes in and relates what happened to them, or you're sending out testers to gather the evidence. And that was to prove the intention to discriminate because of membership in a protected class. You mentioned another way that these cases are proved. What's that?
So there's another line of cases or theory of liability that's regardless of the intent of the housing provider, their actions can be illegal and prescribed by the Fair Housing Act if they have a disparate impact or they have the effect of making housing unavailable or excluding members of a protected class. So just because a landlord doesn't necessarily mean to exclude families with children, if they have a policy that says we only rent 2-bedroom apartments to 2 or fewer people, that could, depending on the sizes of families in the area, that could have a disparate impact on families with children, and that too can be illegal after you go through several other steps.
So in other words, this sounds like a policy that on its face seems fair and neutral, but when it's actually applied, one group of people who are in a protected class more than another group of people.
Exactly. So disparate impact is always based on a neutral policy or practice. Again, unintentional. The landlord or the mortgage lender whomever comes up with this policy thinking that it's a good idea, but it has the effect of excluding people based on a protected class.
And that's what the U.S. Supreme Court upheld last month in its decision. Could you tell us a little bit about the facts of that case that came before the U.S. Supreme Court?
Sure. So that case was brought originally in 2008 in federal court in Texas, and it was brought by a nonprofit called the Inclusive Communities Project. And their mission and their programs and services focus on helping lower income, mostly African American, housing choice voucher holders move out of high poverty neighborhoods into more opportunity areas in the Dallas metro area. And they usually help their clients locate in low-income housing tax credit buildings because those buildings have to take housing choice voucher holders. So when they're trying to help these folks move into communities of opportunity, they notice that a lot of those affordable housing opportunities, those LIHTC properties, were not in communities of opportunity. They were actually located in highly concentrated areas of minority populations in poverty. And so they looked at the policy, the plan that the Texas Department of Housing and Community Development administers, who give out those tax credits to build those buildings. They looked at that plan and they saw that some of the requirements and scoring systems in that plan actually prevented those affordable housing opportunities from locating in higher opportunity, basically suburbs in the area. And so this nonprofit, the Inclusive Communities Project, or ICP, sued the Texas Department of Housing and Community Development and said, look, the way that you provide these tax credits violates the Fair Housing Act because it has a disparate impact on race. You're making housing unavailable to African Americans because you're not allowing housing opportunities in white neighborhoods.
So how does this U.S. Supreme Court case help in proving a violation of fair housing laws? In particular, now that the U.S. Supreme Court has given its blessing to proving a case by disparate impact, what does that really mean?
I think the Supreme Court decision will help the fair housing movement by clarifying that those types of neutral policies or practices, whether they're instituted intentionally or not, can really serve to perpetuate segregation and block housing opportunities for people. And let me note, and this is very important, that the Supreme Court just confirmed what was in the original Fair Housing Act. And I think the number is 9 courts of appeals across the country since the inception of the Fair Housing Act have held that this type of liability, this disparate effect type of violation, was in the original Fair Housing Act. So this doesn't dramatically change the law or the landscape of fair housing. It merely it's the SCOTUS on the record saying, yes, everyone has been right all along. There is disparate impact liability under the Fair Housing Act. I think it's helpful because in order to prove this type of case, you don't have to inquire into the subjective intent of the actors, right? I don't have to try to crawl into the head of a landlord or members of a board of supervisors to determine if they intentionally want to exclude people of color or families with children. I'm simply looking at their policy. And again, many times these are not intentionally discriminatory policies. They may have sounded like a good idea at the time, but we take an objective look at that policy. We run the numbers for that particular geography, and that varies depending on the case. And we see how that policy has an effect on members of a protected class. And the analysis doesn't start there. Even if it does have a disparate impact, the housing provider, the municipality, then gets a chance to justify that policy. And if they say, hey, here's our substantial, legitimate, non-discriminatory reason for this policy, unless I can then show as a plaintiff that there's a less discriminatory alternative, that policy can stand, even if it does have a disparate impact. So the stats alone don't make the case. And Justice Kennedy was very clear about that in his opinion. He's like, a mere statistical disparity doesn't equal liability. You still have to go through this deeper analysis. And the outcome of that is a smarter policy, right? If we get to that third step where we say, you have a good reason, but we've got a better way to achieve that reason that has a less discriminatory effect, I think ultimately that leads to better policies around the country.
And the last recent fair housing development, and this happened just this month, the Obama administration issued new federal regulations talking about finally enforcing, a provision of the Fair Housing Act called Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing. And this applies basically to government actors. What does all of that mean?
Well, I'm glad that you said that this is finally being enforced. So this is the same idea as disparate impact. The duty for recipients of federal funding to affirmatively further fair housing, or AFFH, has been, just like disparate impact liability, in the Fair Housing Act from its inception in 1968. To your point, that duty has not been enforced by HUD. And HUD really has the authority and the power to enforce this obligation, not private actors. But they did just issue new regulations that are intended to clarify what that duty to affirmatively further fair housing means. It's a great new reg. It lays out a step-by-step process for recipients of federal funding. We're talking about CDBG, home funds, public housing authorities, you know, basically municipalities. This is how you further fair housing. This is what you are obligated to do. And it's not just stop discriminating. You actually have to take affirmative actions to undo the segregation and the concentrations of poverty that, frankly, government actors are responsible for, including from the 60s. And the regs give them the tools to do that. It provides various data sets for localities to be able to pull numbers that are specific to their jurisdiction to see what fair housing problems are occurring in their neighborhoods. And then they do have to take meaningful actions, is what the reg says, to overcome those barriers. And I think this makes a lot of sense, Marty. Our tax dollars have been going to these localities who have intentionally and maybe even unintentionally perpetuated segregation, which, you know, has really divested a lot of our neighbors and our communities from opportunities. I think our tax dollars should be spent furthering fair housing so that there's equal opportunity for all.
So this doesn't sound like exactly a new dawn in fair housing, but more a new clarification and reinforcement of what should have been happening all along.
Exactly. I think it will come to those localities who have been phoning this duty in and checking a box that they've completed a report about fair housing, but not actually taking meaningful steps to breathe life into those report and to take, you know, action to decrease segregation. I think it will feel like a pretty big shock to them, but I think that's important. And what will really matter here is the level to which HUD enforces this.
And what would those meaningful steps look like?
Well, we talked a little bit about where affordable housing opportunities are located. I think that's a really important one. So jurisdictions that have heretofore blocked the ability for developers to come in and build mixed income, affordable housing opportunities near quote unquote good schools and job opportunities and public transportation accessibility to get to those jobs in those schools. I mean, all of those things that make a community vibrant, there are jurisdictions that have blocked off those opportunities to certain segments of the population, to members of certain protected classes. And so meaningful action will be planning processes and ordinances and a hard look at existing laws to make sure that those opportunities, that there are more of those opportunities and that those opportunities are open to all.
So finally, getting back to the opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court, what is the bottom line here? What has the U.S. Supreme Court said is the duty in enforcing and bringing to life the Fair Housing Act?
Legal jargon aside, I think Justice Kennedy, who was writing for the court, and this was a very close opinion, it was a 5-4 opinion, fair housing advocates were terrified that it was going to come out the other way, but I think Justice Kennedy really gets that this isn't about a burden-shifting framework, and again, the legal jargon. He begins and ends his opinion with a close analysis of how segregation in this country started, how it's continued, and how it really is hurting us all. So I'd love to read the last sentence in the opinion from Justice Kennedy that I think really drives home the importance of fair housing laws. So he says, quote, "The Fair Housing Act must play an important part in avoiding the Kerner Commission's grim prophecy that our nation is moving toward two societies, one black, one white, separate and unequal. So he acknowledges, and this is again quoting him, "The court acknowledges the Fair Housing Act's continuing role in moving the nation toward a more integrated society."
Well said. Well, thank you very much. We have been speaking with Helen Hardiman. She is the Fair Housing Director at Housing Opportunities Made Equal. And we have been talking about the Fair Housing Act, the recent Supreme Court decision last month upholding what the law has always been, that a case can be proved by the disparate impact of seemingly neutral policies, as well as the new rules for affirmatively furthering fair housing. Thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, Marty. Thanks.
That's all for this week's Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. This show is heard every Wednesday from 12:30 to 1 p.m. The show is the sole responsibility of Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. To see if you can get free civil legal aid, call during intake hours. These are Monday through Thursday, 9 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. and 1 p.m. to 2:30 p.m. The phone number is 200-6046 for intake, 648-1012 for the main number, and 1-800-868-1012 to call toll-free. This show provides only general legal information. If you have a legal problem and need specific legal advice about your situation, contact an attorney. If you can't afford one, call Central Virginia Legal Aid Society. Almost all employees in Virginia are covered by workers' compensation, but what happens when employers don't have the required insurance? Join us next week when Laura Collins at the Virginia Workers' Compensation Commission explains the uninsured workers provision in a rebroadcast of a show originally heard on July 23, 2014. That's Law for the Rest of Us next week on the Central Virginia Legal Aid Radio Show. I'm Marty Wegbright.